Early this morning, the British Royal Air Force carried out its first airstrikes on ISIS in Syria, hours after members of parliament voted to expand their fight against the terrorist organization. While the Allies drop bombs from the air, the ISIS fighters hold territory on the ground in Iraq and Syria. In a moment, we shall see how territorial expansion by ISIS gives them greater access to oil. But first, a look at the ISIS bullet train, how ISIS has created a logistical network that can resupply fighters in a matter of hours. Erica Solomon, Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times, says ISIS is a quick study, scaling up its arms distribution capacity in a way that is changing the nature of warfare in the region.
For a long time, we assumed that ISIS didn't need much because they had captured so much territory. They hold about half of Syria and a third of Iraq, and they've captured lots of armories from Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's forces, as well as several Iraqi military bases full of millions of dollars of U.S. equipment. But what we found when we were speaking to arms dealers, old arms dealers from the region, is that there's still one thing they need: bullets.
And this is like $1 million a month. That's when they're not even fighting at peak levels?
Right. So what we found, we tried to speak to fighters on the ground, people who had fought with them or are still fighting with them, to ask them, well, how much do you use? And the thing is, even in areas where there was relatively low fighting, such as a typical month in the city of Deir ez-Zor, which is sort of at a standoff right now with the Syrian army, between ISIS and the Syrian army, they were still on some months averaging about $1 million if there were skirmishes in some parts of the front line. And if you just look at a week of a relatively large battle, not a huge one, such as the kind of offensives they sometimes do on the nearby military base, that alone could cost another $1 million in the worth of bullets that they use.
So how does an order get formulated? Who makes the order? Where does it get placed? And then how does the bullet order find its way to the place where it needs to be, according to the ISIS leadership?
It's actually kind of an interesting system. There's what's called like the higher military council, which is associated with the top leadership, and they have the final say in what's purchased and where it's moved. And they sort of communicate through couriers with what we call the roving committee. This is a group of military commanders who go around Syria and Iraq checking out the battlefronts, figuring out what they need, and also determining prices. So they actually set prices for what they're willing to pay on the typical types of bullets every few days, we found. Arms dealers, who are, you know, typical black market traders who might have been involved in this kind of stuff for years, got approached by ISIS when it took over and basically offered a ticket with a stamp of approval saying, you're allowed to buy for us. And they communicate using WhatsApp, actually, which is a free texting application, with different military centers around the region.
And if you're on the border of Turkey and Syria listening to the communications take place, how do you understand that what's going on is arms trading? How did you get some sort of access to essentially a coded radio traffic language?
So some of it is a little more secretive than others, of course. But what I found actually a bit accidentally when I was on the border with Iraq and Syria with the Iraqi Kurdish Peshmerga forces, they like to listen in on these ISIS walkie-talkie frequencies. And they kept talking about kebab and salad. And I thought maybe they were ordering lunch, but the Peshmerga said, no, this is some kind of code for weapons. And so I asked fighters who used to fight with ISIS as well as arms dealers, and they said, yeah, that's really common. We change it around. They told me that kebab, for example, would have probably been some type of anti-aircraft gun weaponry, and salad would be Kalashnikov bullets, probably because there's different types. So it's a mix, like a salad, as one guy told me.
Erica, before we go, people have the impression that ISIS has changed the game in arms trading in the Middle East, something that's been going on for centuries. And do they have a sense also that ISIS is here to stay?
Problem, what we see over and over again when we look at ISIS is how well it manages to enmesh itself within systems that already existed. So whether it's, you know, using local traders to bring in goods, using arms dealers to buy weapons, they sort of co-opt everyone in a way that benefits everyone. And that makes it really hard to find a way to extract them from the picture without hurting all the people that, you know, the international coalition, the Americans, local governments would like to get on their side to help fight them.
Erica Solomon, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Erica Solomon is Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times. She spoke to us from Beirut. This is The Takeaway. ISIS's bullets and bombs trade is financed by its access to oil, more and more of it. That kind of money can trump a lot of other strategic considerations. For instance, Russian officials have accused Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his family from personally benefiting from oil-to-cash transactions with the so-called Islamic State. President Erdogan called those charges slanderous. Turkey has not lost its moral values, he said, to buy oil from a terrorist organization. He was giving a speech at Qatar University. But Robert Bench, managing partner of Pellicord, an oil and gas company, says the Russian accusations, true or not, indicate that ISIS has gotten to be a big enough player to compete with Moscow in the oil market. Suddenly being a big player, says Bench, poses some problems for ISIS. It may have become too big to fail in the oil trade.
One of their main sources of revenue to fund their operations is oil that has been taken from Syria and Iraq. That production then is sold primarily into the Turkish marketplace as either Iraqi or Kurdish oil, and then that oil makes its way into Turkey and then into Europe.
How do they launder the oil and turn it from ISIS oil into Iraqi or Syrian oil?
It's at the end sales point where that blind eye, as I would call it, is being turned. And Turkey's receiving and or other countries are receiving that oil, and they're not basically looking at or acknowledging where that oil is coming from. They're looking at the proceeds. And so it's not necessarily oil that's coming from the Iraqi oil ministry. It'll come from private producers. They're just not checking to see or caring, more likely, to see whom that producer is that it's coming from, and that's how it essentially laundered.
Is it your impression that Turkey is dependent on ISIS oil? They could get it from elsewhere, including Russia, for that matter.
Anything that's going to lower their dependence on other countries, especially somebody like Russia, they're going to rely and or need that production. This is production that was coming to them legally at points in time, and now is coming to them illegally. That should be sanctioned oil. It's not sanctioned oil. So what you'll have is you'll have some groups that now will continue to purchase that oil and some industrial groups that will not. And that's why you've seen the Russian ministry accuse President Erdogan's son being a direct beneficiary of that. I can't count to the veracity of that story, but I can say with some conviction that there are Turkish groups that are, in fact, receiving ISIS oil and reselling it into the country.
And they're on Syrian territory, so I'm assuming they acquire facilities in Syria. What is their access to Iraqi oil? Are they drilling, or are they coming upon sites in Iraq that are already pumping?
They're acquiring producing assets. They're not like an oil and gas company that has producing assets and they're out there drilling oil and gas wells. What they're doing is they're seizing the entirety of the infrastructure. They're stealing the refineries and they're using all that to produce into Turkey and to other countries.
The way the oil market works, does ISIS have to actually militarily seize a facility in Iraq, or can they just pay to get what it's producing without actually acquiring it militarily?
No, they're acquiring it militarily. There's no intent on ISIS's part to pay somebody for production. They're seizing property. This is a military operation that they're running, and they are then taking those properties, those producing properties and that infrastructure that existed both in Iraq and Syria, and they're then using that for their own purposes.
How much of the Iraqi capacity do you think ISIS has at its disposal right now based on pre-war estimates of what Iraq could have pumped in the old days?
It seems to me the best estimates that we have are in the 25% to 30% range of Iraqi crude that they've been able to abrogate. That's a couple hundred thousand barrels a day.
If they can convert that into cash money almost immediately, how is that getting paid? Is that credits from Turkish banks? Is that cash? Is that dollar transfers through offshore banking institutions?
It's all of the above. Yeah, I mean, you're talking about a multi-billion dollar business. This for ISIS is their primary business, their secondary business, and I've seen figures as high as $1 billion a year, is extortion. But this is their primary source of income.
So who's going to be helping them in the financial world to basically clear these transactions? It can't just be the Turks, right?
No, it's not. And I couldn't necessarily point a finger what's helping the United States and everyone with regard to fighting terrorism are low oil prices. But the problem with that is because of low oil prices, you have ISIS having to seize more oil to continue to finance their operations.
If one was, you know, in Vienna making some sort of financial transaction that involved a purchase or a sale on the oil market, what would you look for if you were trying to figure out if an individual broker or trader had some sort of ISIS connection?
It's quite easy. Where does the crude come from? You have the ability to trace oil from its origin. Now, from a trader standpoint, if I'm dealing with a trader in London or a trader in Geneva that I'm swapping oil with, you're relying upon that trader to give you clean crude. And the trader will know where that crude came from.
So there are people in Geneva and London and possibly even on the COMEC who know what's going on here.
If you're purchasing ISIS oil, you know it. There's no getting around it. There are ways to disguise that. The ways of disguising that right now seem to be the trucking of that oil into Turkey primarily. But ultimately, if you're purchasing that crude, you're going to end up knowing about it, especially if you're the first purchaser.
How much could you pocket from a single transaction at the scale of what ISIS has developed right now?
Well, traders are making millions of dollars on this oil, millions of dollars. The ISIS oil industry is $1 billion in size. You're making hundreds of millions on an annual basis doing this. So it's pretty significant. But I have great comfort in the fact that you always have people that also will not deal with something like that as well. That's easy for me as an American. The thought of me funding terrorism is a disgusting thought. But there are people, as you get closer, that are more like-minded with that terrorist group, or that they're going to be willing to do something like that. You have to have a significant amount of integrity and honesty when a significant amount of money is put in front of you. And some people just don't have that barometer.
Robert Bench is managing partner of Pellicord, a Western-owned oil and gas company that works in conflict zones around the world.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.